The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now it's time for the Friday Forum. Sinead O'Carroll, editor of the Journal.ie, is with us, as is Gary Gannon, Social Democrats TD for Dublin Central, and Martin Hayden, Minister of State at the Department of Agriculture, Fine Gael TD for Kildare South. Are you all Twitter users?
Yes.
Sinead, the journalistic tool that is Twitter, have you seen any impact on what's happening in your account?
This morning. So I've been followed by about 40 people who definitely don't exist. People who are like accounts that are definitely bots that have just been set up in the last couple of weeks that have no followers and only following a handful of people. And so you can tell that they're bots. So they all started following this morning. That's the kind of stuff that teams in Twitter would usually be stopping. I've also got a few DMs into my inbox, which usually wouldn't make it into your inbox, that are obviously people you don't follow. They're like asking me, do I want to supplement my income with some part-time work? And also some photos that have been hidden. So I obviously wouldn't want to see what are in those photos. So that's, I think, probably the very, very thinnest edge of the wedge.
Yeah, I haven't been on Twitter this morning. I've been busy in other meetings. But look, in general, you just really worry
Gary?
I haven't noticed anything this morning, but I have noticed like a large swathe of people who I would have followed, taken a lot of information from. They've removed themselves from the platform, gone onto other platforms such as Mastodon and stuff, which I can't get a hand on at the minute.
It seems to be a bit complicated.
It is a bit complicated, but I have seen people starting to transfer away from Twitter, which I think is sad because it's such an important medium for a variety of reasons.
Mm. Now, Sinead, you were making the point during the commercial break that in terms of news from maybe oppressed peoples, that Twitter has been useful.
Yeah, if you look at what's happening in Iran now, the social media sites have been very important for people in Iran to be able to get information out of Iran, for people to be able to communicate with each other. And also when we follow things that are happening, especially maybe in war-torn areas, Twitter is a big tool for humanitarian workers, for journalists on the ground getting things out. So one of my colleagues made the point that Elon Musk thinks it's a chat room for elites, but really it's a lot more than that. And I think a lot of us talk about how horrible Twitter can be as a space to be in sometimes, but the reason we're all there is because there's a lot of good in there as well. So I think we're all kind of coming to terms with that now,
Handle on why he's doing what he's doing? Now, he has hundreds of billions to his name, although how fragile that though those sums are, we don't know. So if he throws 40 billion down the drain, it may not be, you know, it won't see him short of a dinner or a drink.
It does seem a little bit like the sums are as fragile as his ego a little bit. It seems people were mean to him on there and all of a sudden he wants to be in control of the platform. This technology is not just something that's kind of exclusive to kind of Elon and these elites. This is something, for example, a couple of weeks ago in the Dáil, I had a activist in from the LGBTQI community in Afghanistan. I found that out. I made contact with that person through Twitter, through what you're trying to convey to us, and then we were able to help them in the Dáil. Elon Musk and the type like him have now just taken this medium and say they own it and are spoiling it for everybody. And it just seems to be ego to the core of it.
Look, it's a nature of modern day communication as well. We become very dependent on these mediums. So even my constituency work in Kildare South, I would have people would send me direct messages as a way of raising certain points to me that mightn't necessarily have Googled my email address to just find it easier to do that. So we become quite dependent on it. And then you realise when there's likes of a WhatsApp outage, you realise, oh my God, how do we manage without it? We will manage. And if Elon keeps messing with it, you know, we'll move to other forums and we'll be at the loss of Twitter, albeit there are negative parts of it there. But if it's well enough policed, I think it's a really good medium.
Especially because it'll be easily lost in terms of the tech. And just going back to his money, Pat, like the 44 billion, it's not his money. He got this financed. So that 44 billion could actually mean a lot more to him if it goes down the drain because there'll be people asking for it back. There's like some of the money is
He was selling shares, Tesla shares, and then he had to say to people the other day, I don't really want to be a CEO of any particular company and I'll get out of each of my many jobs as quickly as I can.
Well, he obviously doesn't, you know, do this hands-on approach in all of his companies. Tesla's a lot more successful under his remit. So you'd imagine there's people there who keep him out of certain decision-making. But I don't think he'll ever personally feel the impact of losing. Obviously, he'll be able to shield his own personal finances, but I'd imagine he may or may not. He may not last as the richest person in the world.
When you talk about what happened to your account this morning and the bots that would have been detected by the hardworking, hardcore personnel in Twitter, he doesn't seem to have looked under the bonnet. to know how the nuts and bolts of this company actually work.
And the thing is, with a company like this, when Jack Dorsey's setting out to make Twitter, he obviously has ambitions for Twitter, but you don't have the resources for making what Twitter needs to be. So if you're building a tech company and you know it's going to be as big as Twitter, you would have to have thousands of engineers, and you would have to make sure your code is all aligned and you have it all backtracked. And so if you step to B, you know how to get back to A, and all the way back to, from Z all the way back to A. If you're Jack Dorsey in your room, you can't do that. So there'll be foundation blocks of Twitter built on that you can never get back to, but are incredibly important. So what happens is, if you don't look under the bonnet and you don't know what pieces are really necessary for Twitter to work, and then you just let go of the person who looks after that.
I remember when I worked in RT one day, in the top corridor in the main studio building, the floor was removed, and they could do it. It was a segmented floor. They could remove it. And there were guys working on all the cabling, and they were laying new cables. And I said, well, why can't you use the old ones? And he said, we don't know where they go or what they do. If we disconnect these, we don't know what's going to go off.
So it's the same thing when you're talking about digital infrastructure. This everything is built on something else. Mm. So, you know, if in a perfect world, you would be able to go right way back to the start. But, you know, as good as the coders are, that just isn't possible. Excellent articles in tech reviews. There's a MIT Tech Review that has an engineer explaining all of this, if people are interested in kind of figuring out how it could get so bad this quickly.
But there's no way that the old Twitter carried so many staff that it didn't need, which is kind of what Elon would have you think. So by letting so many people go potentially very, very quickly, is undermining the whole...
But the type of staff they let go, it's the staff that are working in the human rights aspect. Yeah. They're looking at different policies across EU, across the Americas, for example. Those staff have now gone. Yes. So what's being left is almost this almost kind of... And a wink to the right wing elements of Twitter to come in and be kind of degrading towards people. And if that, it's just not going to be a nice place to be, and people will remove themselves. And these technologies change quickly. I remember being absolutely obsessed with Bebo, for example. And that goes, Facebook similar.
Can he save it though? I mean, can he, if he extracts himself from all of this, he'd have to eat humble pie and try to get some of the key people back.
I'm sure he can, because people haven't left the platform. Advertisers have, but I don't think they would, they haven't left it for good. And people haven't left it for good. And, you know, Elon keeps making the point himself that traffic at Twitter is still as big. Now, there have been failures. Like, people have been, you know, getting error messages because there's been so much usage and they can't handle it. But no, I think it is big enough to be saved. They have the people still using the platform. But if the user experience keeps going as it is, that the more weeks that happens, the harder it will be, and the less advertising revenue you get in every day, the more money he's losing every single day.
But the big practical advantage of Twitter as well is, and I see this at home, let's say you're following the GAA activity in your local club scene in the county or whatever, it's the real time posting you can actually see the match you're not at, what's the score, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and like, there's an awful lot of people who are on Twitter who will never tweet but use it for that instant information, and the same with getting news.
He's quoted, I don't know whether you saw the tweet, allegedly from him borrowing that old thing from horse racing, you know, how do you make a million from horse racing? Well, you start with 5 million. And he did how do you make a billion from Twitter? Well, you start with 44 billion, and that's where you might end up. Now, Gary, are you on Putin's banned list?
No, I was raging. I was re-clicking to see was an email coming through or anyone calling me from the department today. But no, I'm not on the banned list. But actually, look, this is somewhat to be a source of amusement, but there are serious implications behind it. I have been calling since February for the expulsion of the Russian ambassador, because the role he's playing at the minute isn't one that's facilitating dialogue, discussion. There is no avenues for diplomacy there. And now the Russian Federation are coming through and they're sanctioning 52 Irish politicians, just almost as a way of, for their home audience. Like, this doesn't actually mean anything here. But at home, they get to say they're being tough.
No one's going to Russia anytime soon.
Nobody is going to Russia anytime soon. But this is all, again, it's for the Russian audience as opposed to ourselves. And this is all the while missiles are raining down in Ukraine. So what is the purpose of... Because, I mean, this is kind of gossiping.
But send him home and then they expel the four we have left, or I don't know how many we've left, but very few to start with. So, you know, do you do that? And
I almost think we are at the point where we have to. Yeah, what's the alternative? We keep them here and then it's just used for propaganda back in Russia. If there is no space for diplomacy or there is no tools for engagement, what's the purpose of the Russian ambassador being here at the same time when heinous acts of violence are being rained down upon the people in Ukraine? Yeah.
bombing them back to the Stone Age is what they're after. You know, no water, no power, and what then?
One of our journalists, Niall O'Connor, had a story this morning that Russia refused to engage in the Irish diplomatic effort to have the declaration banning high explosive warfare. So this is something that our diplomats started back actually in the days of Syria and have got over the line, which is obviously a really incredibly important timing of Ukraine. But there was, and now it's kind of obvious that there would be no diplomatic engagement with from Russia on something like this when they're doing it at the same time. But they're the kind of things that diplomats should be even faux engaging in, you know, putting a face forward that they would.
But this is going back, the technique, almost to the Middle Ages, where you starve a population to death. Yeah. And then you, when they're weakened, you go in and massacre them. That's what he's at, Martin.
Yeah, look, you know, conscious that the first snows have fallen in Kyiv this week, and at the same time, he continues to bomb, you know, their heating infrastructure and their electricity and their power and their water supply. So, you know, the point has been made here before. Well, Ireland is militarily neutral. We are not politically neutral. And we continue to use our position, you know,
to highlight this. But what about getting rid of Yuri Filatov?
You know, I think it's, it's a handy thing to say, but diplomatically, you know, and what they've done this week in terms of the list of the 52, diplomatically is unacceptable. In reality, it makes no difference. None of our politicians or my colleagues who are were planning to go and do business.
Have you cited the 52 yet?
Yes, I've seen the list this morning, but irrespective of who they are, none of them are planning on going to business in Moscow on behalf of the government, or none of them are planning on going to Moscow for a holiday either. So it's a propaganda stunt by them. But I do think there is a merit in continuing to engage, even if it is to continue to tell the diplomats what they're doing.
It is interesting that they've chosen Ireland, because I was looking yesterday to see what other countries. So it's not completely run on Ireland, but it's definitely a concerted effort to make the point through Ireland about European Union. Yeah. So it is interesting that Ireland has been chosen, and it probably is because we have to make these statements about neutrality. You know, Simon Coveney yesterday saying we're not neutral on this.
Yes.
Like this, that's not what we mean by neutrality. And it feels like we have to keep explaining that to the Russians, because that's why we're being the ones kind of cast.
Russia have also kind of seen the Irish embassy as a space where they tried to expand beyond what was necessary over the last 10 years. There are espionage going on from particularly, I mean, think about the Russian or the undersea fiber optic cables that transfer information between the US.
Yeah, but I spoke to ex-ambassador Ray Bassett yesterday, and he says, "Yeah, of course we know, or the authorities in Ireland know who the spies are and their names and everything, but the view is it's better to keep an eye on them and know where they are, because if they're removed from Ireland, they'll fetch up somewhere else and do their spying elsewhere, and we'll get a new lot of spies coming in."
And just to say, the expansion that they looked to do in the embassy was blocked, and it was not let happen. You
know? Yeah, but it was blocked, but the intent was still very much there. But in terms of their engagements in the Irish Sea, in terms of going in, tracking around the sea fibre optic cables, we can't block that because we actually don't have the infrastructure that they want in terms of our navy.
I often wonder, though, could it have been different? I knew in a Russian ambassador years ago called Gennady Uranov at the time of Gorbachev. Great character, and we had many's the party in the embassy where you had to down 5 shots of vodka before you started. But even then we used to joke that the waiters were all KGB. But how it might have been different if the West had been slightly more generous to the disintegrating Soviet Union?
I don't know. You could argue the West was not active enough in 2014 when Crimea was annexed.
No, but that was too late. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. And at that time, like, I would think Gorbachev's era and perestroika, relations did improve after the Cold War.
And this conversation is going back to World War II. Like, there's a really fascinating book called The Daughters of Yalta, which you just reminded me of when you were talking about the 5 shots of vodka, because the Yalta conference, all the waiters were actually KGB spies, and listening to, and that was the whole thing between FDR and Churchill. Like, how friendly are we? How friendly can we be to Russia?
Spies don't need to be up beside you with a shot of vodka now. They can actually probably listen to our phones.
But that book outlines some of from the daughter's perspective of the three leaders. But it outlines the problems with trying to figure out how nice can we be to these people. Well, when we know they're spying on us, when we know that nothing we're saying, even in this conference, is being taken in good faith.
And then there's also...
It's not a new problem.
Yeah, and that is not a new problem.
But the Russians would be the only country that we would suspect would listen to our conversations.
Look, you expect that. But there's also this suggestion that in some way, if the West wasn't less aggressive, there wouldn't be an attempt at expansion. And actually, the last 400 or 500 years of Russian history actually completely discredits that. Russia have always tried to expand their territory. And in the invasion of Ukraine, Putin and his allies have been very clear that this is about the eradication of the Iranian or the Ukrainian identity. This is, they don't see Ukraine as a country in its own right. That hasn't been provoked by the West. That is actually within what Putin has said in of himself. He doesn't see Ukraine as an entity, a sole country in and of itself. And part of his ambition here is to remove that.
Yeah. How do you see it all end? I mean, does Ukraine have to say, okay, you can hang on to Crimea, but give us back the rest? Is that the...
It does look like that's going to be the pressure from the US, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
Which is why Zelensky is on his kind of PR mission at the moment to try and not let that happen. But
does Zelensky at some stage have his Michael Collins moment? Possibly.
Well, which moment? Which
that's
moment?
The, yeah.
That's a, whether he is at the end game Michael Collins moment or the treaty.
Well,
one leading, of course, to the other.
It was a treaty I was referencing. You know,
Well, we shall see, because there are those who obviously would like Crimea to be reunited with Ukraine as a whole. Mm. Finally, gambling and new rules to limit the amount of exposure people have to gambling temptation. Sinead, do you have a strong view on this?
I would, if this legislation comes in as, we don't have all the detail, but if it comes in as shown, like massive advertising blocks, a regulator with fairly decent teeth, with fines up to 20 million for companies and prison sentences for people who flout rules, like not being able to give VIP treatment to gamblers. If all of that comes to play, you'd imagine it would make a big difference. A lot of it is stuff that people who have been calling for a better system, because there's so much gambling addiction in this country and so much exposure to insidious gambling. Mm-hmm. So, you'd welcome a lot of it, and without trying to tank the whole industry. Yep. Obviously, like, there's an entertainment part of gambling that you don't want to take out from people because of like the nanny state thing. But there is so much insidious gambling because of the technologies that
wonder,
a lot of it would be
is
welcome,
it, you know. You can't have a betting shop near a school. Well, you'll say, and where I live in Dalkey, there's a betting shop right beside a school. They're not going anywhere anytime soon, I presume. And I have never seen a queue of Loretto girls outside the betting shop looking to put a few bob on.
No, well, it would be the young males that are more prevalent to this than young females. But, in Kildare South, in my constituency, we have Coonwira and Sister Concilio on the team do phenomenal work helping people with addiction. And they have a specialised gambling centre. And when I've been in visiting them, I asked them before, in dealing with people with drug addiction, alcohol addiction and gambling addiction, which is the hardest to cure? And without blinking an eye, I was told it's gambling. Because the family support network, the trust is broken, and they're the ones that struggle the most afterwards. So this is a really important piece of legislation. Our colleague Minister Helen McEntee will be briefing Fine Gael colleagues at it at our Ardesh this weekend and at Lone. And while James Brown has done good work on bringing this through, it's a huge piece of work that's been worked on for a long time. And I'd like to acknowledge the role David Stanton played in the last all as well, and bring it to this point. It's tidying up a lot of different pieces of legislation.
I worked in a well-known gambling company during the last recession, when people were losing their jobs. And what I seen, what I think was purposely done, was a real intent to replace the job with the betting shop. They invested in kind of the coffee, they invested in kind of being able to sit down and be comfortable. And where predominantly young men or men were losing their jobs, they were finding that being replaced by the gambling industry. It was done purposefully. I think this bill is timely in the sense that, once again, we're coming into a cost of living crisis. It's targeted at the online gambling industry in particular. I think that's very, very welcome. We need to get in front of that. There are a couple of lacunas in terms of the legislation itself, in terms of you can still watch Sky Sports and see the gambling banner going by, and we probably won't be able to get in front of that. But we can't confront the people who are directly targeted.
In other words, do what we can do. Yeah. What is within our control.
Part of the problem at the moment is every single place you turn, there's something, there's a strap on telly, there's something on the radio, there's something in the newspaper, there's something online. So there's something on your app, on your phone.
So it's pervasive at the moment, and to try and limit
it. So even if you remove some of those.
And to make one final point, really important measure in this is the banning of the use of credit cards. I know an apprentice plumber back in the day who maxed out four credit cards before his parents found out had racked up over 20,000 of
them. We have to leave it there. Will you pass that over to Sinead? She's going to pick our winner for the Sean Doyle Windows and Doors competition.
I'm really jealous because I've been trying to get a new door.
I didn't trust the politicians because we have five people in there trying to win.
I've already snuck my name in.
Yeah, but what Martin said was that you know, one winner might be a vote, but it'd be four lost votes.
You're giving me away.
So who is it?
My in-laws would be delighted because it's Cork man, Noel Dignan from Cork.
Congratulations, Noel. You have won $7,000 worth of windows or doors from Sean Doyle Windows.ie. All right, that's all we have time for. My thanks to Sinead, to Gary, and to Martin.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.